Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today as co-host, Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
How are you, Dr. Paul?
Doing well.
Good.
And we have a special guest today.
Yes.
And she's not new to our program. She's been with us on two other occasions, and she was very popular on this program because she is able to give us some information and news that you're not going to hear anyplace else. And the guest we have is Vanessa Bealey, and she was on our program before in December and talked about Aleppo, mm-hmm. and revealed a lot about what was going on there, and she was right about it. Today, I think we're going to be talking more about Yemen, so this is going to be very interesting. Vanessa, I want to welcome you to the program again. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Paul. It's great to be back.
Wonderful. It is the biggest problem, and you deal with this all the time, on how do we get the news out, whether it's the British population, the French population. I understand you're in France right now, but certainly to the people in the United States, because they very rarely hear about what's really going on. There's a lot of news, a lot of political news going on in this country, and they're trying to decide which monument to tear down, but they're not talking about how we're wasting money and corrupting world affairs and killing a lot of people. And right now, I think there's a mess over there, and you're starting to address it in Yemen. I'd like to have you just give us a brief summary of what's going on and why the American people ought to be paying a lot more attention to Yemen. Not only American people, but the British and anybody who cares about peace in the world.
Thank you, and thank you for this opportunity to raise awareness on the situation in Yemen, which as it stands currently is, as Rand Paul actually stated, a disaster of biblical proportions. In the first 800 days of this illegal, non-UN mandated war of aggression led by the Saudi coalition, but armed by the three permanent members of the UN Security Council, that is the United States, the UK and France in particular, who have sold billions of weapons to Saudi Arabia in order to enable them to maintain this war of aggression against the Yemeni people. Of course, it's also a bipartisan funding of a war effort, because it was started by Obama in March 2015, but it has been continued by the Trump administration. What I'd like to do is to, if I can very briefly, to cover the events leading up to the Saudi illegal war of aggression, and to demonstrate the illegitimacy of the claims behind this war of aggression. Basically, we know that Yemen had an Arab Spring imposed upon it with strong U.S. infiltration within those revolutionary or so-called revolutionary movements, as we have seen across the region. After that, under the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC initiative, to a large extent, a Saudi puppet president was put in, a transitional president for 2 years, and he had a mandate to draft a constitution and to set up presidential elections, in other words, to take the peaceful political process forward. He failed to do this in the 2 years he was given. Without popular consent, he was given an extension on that mandate for 1 year. He still failed to produce either the constitution or to enable presidential elections. Mm-hmm. He then went on to resign. Now, this is very important. In January 2015, he resigned his post not once but twice, after which he fled to Aden in the south. From there, when he realized that he would not be able to set up, let's say, an alternative government in Aden, he fled to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where afterwards he called upon Saudi Arabia to bomb his own people and to reinstate him, despite his illegitimacy and the fact that he had resigned his post. Now, under those circumstances, Jamal Ben Omar, who was the UN peace envoy at the time, told the world, basically, that he had no understanding why the Saudi war of aggression had started in the end of March 2015, the 26th of March, when Yemenis themselves were well on the road to peaceful resolution, and that included the Houthi element. Mm-hmm. So peaceful resolution, political resolution, was on its way when the Saudi coalition began bombing the Yemeni people. Now, basically, our understanding is that what we were seeing was a desire for political emancipation by the Yemeni people. The Houthis are cited in Western media as being the face of this uprising against Saudi colonization. But in fact, the Houthis, as a tribal element, only represent less than 1% of the population of Yemen. So again, a large degree of fake news in that narrative. Mm-hmm. What this actually was a popular movement. The Houthis gave it very much their blessing and their, if you like, the coverage for this movement, but it was certainly an homogenous popular movement uprising against decades of Saudi proxy colonization mm-hmm. of this country and reduction to a vassal state.
Okay, I think Daniel has a question for you.
Yeah. It's interesting the way you portrayed is obviously, as you know, not how it's portrayed here. When it is covered at all, it will be something like we've got to guard against Iranian influence in Yemen. The Iranians are behind the whole thing. It's really a proxy war for Iran to extend the Shia crescent, et cetera, et cetera. Now, is there an Iranian element at all? Is it overplayed? Does it not exist? Why is there so much focus on this?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia definitely feels threatened, as you quite rightly say. It perceives that there is a huge Iranian influence to the north of Saudi Arabia on its borders in Syria and Iraq, for example. And its greatest fear was to have an equivalent Iranian influence to its southern borders in Yemen. But what must be made very clear here, Iran has actually, and I was in Tehran last year and speaking to them about what involvement they had in Yemen, and they said absolutely none. At that time, when I was in Tehran, there was no elected government in Yemen. So their reasoning was they couldn't work with a country that had no existing political governance. However, in August of 2016, another fact that has been completely airbrushed by Western media and Western governments, Yemen actually went through a political process, a constitutionally legitimate process of electing a coalition government in Yemen that represents across the board probably 85% of the population and is doing what it can to govern and to maintain some degree of infrastructure and structure itself within a country that is under attack on so many levels. The Iranian influence was made very clear that this was a fake sectarian narrative being promulgated by Saudi Arabia, its coalition, and the U.S. coalition, when in November 2016, Iran actually made a statement saying that it wanted a military base inside Yemen, and that was rejected by the current government, making it very clear that, no, this is very much a Yemeni, homogenous, independent battle for freedom from the yoke of Saudi oppression that it suffered mm-hmm. under for decades. It has nothing to do with Iran, and in fact, Iranian influence has largely been rejected. They've had some support in the media and some support internationally, diplomatically, but that's as far as it goes.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to follow up on that because I don't fully understand whether Israel has made a position. Have they stated a position? Do they participate in this? Do they have their sympathies? You've explained that so clearly about how the Iranians are involved or not involved. And we know the British and the Americans and the Saudis have one goal. But has Israel spoken out about their position on this war that's going on?
Israel, there's been various reports of Israel collusion, militarily even, with Saudi Arabia, and we're certainly seeing, a coming together of Saudi Arabia and Israel, particularly in Syria, with obviously the funding of the terrorism that threatens to destabilize Syria, is very much working to the benefit of Israel. In Yemen, under Mansour Hadi, we saw very similar plans of the Balkanization of Yemen the fact that Hadi had agreed to divide the country into six what would effectively be sectarian states, with the Houthi state in the center, Azal, being largely blockaded from both land, air, and sea access. So I don't know if we can say we see that, that there is direct Israeli involvement in Yemen, but there is certainly a degree of benefiting by Israel, and by Israel I also mean obviously the U.S. coalition, with the pressure that is being put on Yemen to come under the tutelage again of Saudi Arabia. But there are also huge resource interests in Yemen. I mean, it's a very complex situation. Mm-hmm. The terrorism in Yemen, of course, was incubated by the U.S. as far back as the late 70s when they created the Taliban, which came from elements in Saudi Arabia and Yemen and then returned to Yemen in the 90s, were declared officially in 2009 when Obama started his so-called war on terror and his drone warfare campaign, which of course did nothing but further radicalize elements within Yemen and actually sort of grow the ranks of the Al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula within Yemen itself. So again, we see a case where the U.S. coalition, which includes Israel, in my opinion, is creating and encouraging and promoting and supporting terrorist elements within countries that threaten to be either allied with, you know, their greatest enemy in the region, Iran, or threaten the image of one of their client states, Saudi Arabia, which is one of the greatest human rights violators on the planet, a complete theo-plutocracy, but yet one that is defended entirely by the United States, the UK, and by Europe because it benefits the military-industrial complex, particularly mm-hmm. Lockheed Martin. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You now we started going into an area I think now that is a good place for us to discuss. In the news today is this horrible fact that just until the end of June of this year, there have been more airstrikes on Yemen than the entire year of 2016, 5,676 versus 3,936 for the whole year last year. Can you give us a sense of the UN involvement in this? What's happening on the ground? What is the UN doing? Are they a force for good or a force for not good in this conflict?
Yeah, that's a very important question. Thank you, Daniel. The UN, in fact, Francis Boyle, a professor of law at Illinois University, has actually stated that the UN is complicit in the genocide under its own charters of the people of Yemen. And I will explain why. The Saudi war of aggression began on the 25th of March 2016, so it did not have a UN mandate. It had the green light from President Obama. The UN Security Council adopted Resolution 2216 on the 14th of April 2016, so 3 weeks after the war of aggression had actually started. Now, Resolution 2216 was an embargo, so a freezing of assets and an arms embargo on five named individuals, not on 27 million Yemenis. However, that sanction has, or that resolution, has been allowed to be exploited by the Saudi coalition to blockade, humanitarianly blockade 27 million Yemenis, to prevent medical treatment, to prevent food, to destroy infrastructure, essential water treatment plants, water desalination plants, schools, hospitals, all forms of medical centers, agricultural centers, fishing areas, etc. Under Resolution 2216, which is also based upon the illegitimate fugitive twice resigned President Mansour Hadi's legitimacy. So let me make that very clear. The resolution is based entirely upon an illegitimate premise and is being allowed to be used by the Saudi coalition to collectively punish or to unilaterally coerce 27 million Yemeni people to succumb to Saudi Arabian colonization and oppression and corruption. Mm-hmm. So the UN is effectively allowing, as it did in Iraq in the early 90s, the starvation of 27 million people. 10,000 people have died in Yemen of treatable diseases because of the blockade on Sana'a Airport. They've been unable to leave the country to receive medical aid abroad. 450,000 people are suffering under cholera. The majority of those are children under the age of 15. Under the bombing campaign, 13,000 civilians have lost their lives. Of that, 3,000 at least are children. Not to mention, you know, the infrastructure that has been destroyed, the lack of clean water, the lack of medical aid, and the lack of food. Even economic structures have been affected. The Central Yemen Bank has been moved to Aden under the control of ex-president fugitive Mansour Hadi. And since September 2016, salaries to public sector workers have been stopped. So that, again, pro rata, affects probably around 7 million people in Yemen and reduces them down to levels of poverty that cannot even be imagined. The UN has also then enforced a unilateral verification and inspection mechanism on goods entering Yemen, which has increased the delays rather than facilitating those goods entering Yemen. So the UN, in my opinion, is entirely complicit, along with the UN Security Council, which is the US, the UK, mm-hmm. and France in particular, for the humanitarian disaster that is in Yemen.
You know, you describe so well how the UN doesn't serve a proper purpose of, you know, promoting peace, and they get involved politically and complicate things. But this whole understanding of the tragedy there, and you mentioned sanctions as well as blockades. In my experience in Washington, it was always discouraging to me because people who were sort of in the anti-war coalition would vote against a declaration of war or using military force. Let's go with the easy stuff. We'll just put on some sanctions, and they're not so devastating. Look, just recently, you know, the new sanctions that were voted on in the Congress, just a couple people voted against them, and they think they're not doing much harm. But I think you described and recognized the difference between, you know, sanctions morphing into something like a blockade, and I've always maintained that they're one and the same. What would we do as a country if anybody did any of that to us? We would consider an act of war. And believe me, it just seems, and I bet you know a lot of examples, once it starts with sanctions and blockades and injury, look how many years the Iraqi people suffered. And then there's an all-out war, and it still never ends. So I think that's a very important point that you make about how these things affect the war. And of course, from my viewpoint of having worked in the Congress, it's a real tragedy because, oh, okay, you know, I don't like war, but I'll put on the sanctions. I want to, you know, just make a comment about the political problems that we face with this understanding.
Well, I mean, you know, I perceive if we look at sanctions generally, if we look at them in Syria, if we look at them in Yemen, if we look at them globally in Iran, in North Korea, who do they affect, Dr. Paul? They affect the people. They collectively punish the people for what are perceived to be, you know, in Western media and Western governments, the crimes of their government. So for me, they are nothing more than economic terrorism. And if we look at what the U.S. is effectively doing, particularly the U.S., in Yemen, having created Al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula in the first place, what we actually saw between 2012 and 2015 was almost the eradication of Al-Qaeda by the Houthi forces aligned with the Yemeni national forces. They managed to virtually eradicate them and drive them into a small pocket in the south in Mukalla. Under the Saudi war of aggression, under the bombing, of course, we see yet again the reemergence of Al-Qaeda, the flourishing of Al-Qaeda in the south of Yemen, their retaking of areas that they've been cleansed from by the Houthi and the Yemeni forces. And then we see the usual kind of airdrops and supplies to Islamic extremist forces aligned with Al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula inside Yemen by the Saudi coalition. And we see basically exactly as we saw or have seen and continue to see in Syria, the United States coalition supporting the extremist elements that they claim to be fighting mm-hmm. and actually attacking and demonizing the very forces both in Syria and Yemen that are fighting the real war against terror, the real war against al-Qaeda in Syria, the real war against al-Qaeda in mm-hmm. Yemen.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, Daniel.
Yeah, this is interesting what you're saying about al-Qaeda's return, because I'll tell you, you probably know this already, but this is how it's being sold to the American people. And you probably heard a few weeks ago, it was revealed that U.S. Special Forces are on the ground in Yemen, but this whole thing is packaged up and sold to the American people as, we've got to go in there and fight al-Qaeda. What you're saying is that that's not the case at all.
No, what I'm saying, I mean, we saw and I've been told by eyewitnesses on the ground in Yemen, and I would like to direct everyone to an organization, an NGO, an independent NGO run by a Yemeni American based in Washington called ArdawaRights.org, ARWA, and there you will really find updated information on exactly what is happening on the ground in Yemen. I thoroughly recommend it. But if, for example, we take the landing of the American troops in Mukalla, in the south of Yemen, where AQAP were allegedly strong, AQAP basically laid down their weapons. Now, AQAP were, in my opinion, securing the south, because the WikiLeaks reports in 2008 detailed U.S. and Saudi plans to lay pipelines from the Al-Jawf and Marib area to the center and the north of Yemen, where there are untapped sources of gas and oil, and to take those pipelines down to the south to avoid the Bab el-Mandeb Straits to the west, which is controlled by Yemen, and the Straits of Hormuz to the east, which is obviously controlled by Iran, and to take the pipeline down to the Gulf of Aden. So one could speculate that al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula was working in lockstep with U.S. and Saudi coalition objectives in the south of Yemen, i.e. retaking areas in the south, one, to secure the transportation of oil and gas reserves mm-hmm. from Yemen, but also to take control of the southern ports of Aden, Hodeidah, further inland to Taiz, to secure, if you like, almost a launch pad for terrorism into the Horn of Africa, into southern Arabia, and even further into Asia itself. So, you know, it's a little bit speculation, but mm-hmm. it's actually reinforced by some testimony on the ground in Yemen that the U.S. coalition with the Saudi coalition is working yet again, as we've seen in Syria, alongside the extremist mm-hmm. factions and alongside al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula inside Yemen.
Okay. Daniel has another short one to ask you, mm. before we finish up.
It's not a question. I was just going to mention to Vanessa that, you know, this is all so fascinating and important. And I don't know, you probably heard this, Vanessa, but we do have a conference coming up in Washington, D.C., and I just want to remind our viewers of this conference. There are some tickets that are still available, ronpaulinstitute.org/conference. These are the kinds of issues we're going to be dealing with. Unfortunately, Vanessa won't be there. We'll have to get you next time, Vanessa. But these are the kinds of intractable things. The news we get is not the real news. And so we're thankful that people like Vanessa. So please, if you want to hear more like this, come to the conference.
And Vanessa, we will have to quit, even though I think we could go on for a long time. Yeah. So we'll get you back again. But I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Paul, for having me on and thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you. And I want to thank our viewers for joining us today. And please come back soon to the Liberty Report.